Not one person comes to work in healthcare and says, I'm going to hurt somebody today, or I'm going to cut some corners today, or I'm just not going to do my job today. That's just not how it works. So if you accept that everybody is well-trained and well-intentioned, then you have to really examine the systems in which they work to see why it is that these systems let them down so often.
Welcome to the Better Care Podcast, where we interview clinicians, innovators, and leaders in healthcare to learn about what's going on in the industry, some of the challenges that folks are seeing, and how can we address those issues. And so I'm very excited today to have with me Dr. Tracy Hoke. Tracy is the Chief of Quality and Performance Improvement at the University of Virginia, also holds a faculty position at the Darden School of Business. So Tracy, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah. Well, always love to start a little bit with your background. So you're a pediatrician and a pediatric cardiologist. You've been a medical director at the NIH. Kind of walk me through your path and how that sort of led to you being involved in quality and performance at a leading health system.
Sure. So you're right. I'm a pediatric cardiologist by training. And while I was in fellowship at Hopkins, I had the opportunity to head to the School of Public Health at Bloomberg. And there I acquired an MPH and an outcomes research degree. And that is the moment that I realized that all of my skills in the one-on-one caring of children and families could be magnified if I learned how to apply my energy to population-based thinking, both understanding populations and trends and sort of big data underneath them, and then designing implementation programs, mitigation programs to bring health and wellness, and in a way that you can measure your efforts. So that was when I realized that I was able to think more broadly. And that kind of thinking is what led me to the NIH, where I was a medical officer for heart, lung, and blood. And I was involved in device programs, drug programs, epidemiology work, adults, children, et cetera, some work in resuscitation as well. And again, just working at the federal scale is intimidating and inspiring at the same time, because you realize that not only can you deeply understand data, risk, trends, populations, design and study implementations, but what you then learn will become policy and change how payment is managed and or how services are offered by programs like insurance companies. And so that was my first administrative role. And when my husband was recruited back to UVA to start a hospitalist group, I came to the Children's Hospital and served as the Chief Medical Officer for Children and the Vice Chair of the Department for Outcomes. And that was my first job that looked like quality, because it was measuring clinical care delivery, patient outcomes, and provider outcomes. And so that was my first role in quality. Because I was a cardiologist, we were able to do some things for cardiac surgery kids. And because I'm good with trial design and measurement, I was able to prove it. And that caught the attention of the institution. And in 2013, I became the Chief Quality Officer for UVA Health. And since then, I have been doing the same at a grander and grander scale.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing all that. So as Chief of Quality and Performance Improvement, what does that role actually look like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it's a challenging role, but it's one that I think physician scientists are really well suited for, because we are trained to understand populations, large data sets, identify meaningful trends, and to design implementation programs to get to best practice or to study a new best practice and ultimately change the behavior of providers, which is probably the hardest challenge of my life, because you've got to prove to people who take care of patients who are deeply committed, well-trained, and very busy that something that they do could be better or done differently or perhaps shouldn't be done at all. And that requires a deep understanding of current state and best practice and some willingness to adapt and test new ideas to see if you've really hit on something that should be done differently. But that is the gist of the role at an academic medical center.
Yeah, I think we're going to dive into some of the components you mentioned there as we go a little bit, especially on the provider change. With a portfolio that kind of covers so much, how do you decide where to focus your energy and attention?
Yeah, so as my career has evolved, we have accumulated in our business about 400 or so published measures that are used by benchmarkers, raters, rankers, graders, payers, insurance companies, others. And as you've alluded to, you can't focus on 400 things at a time. And so what we try to do is find the areas of measurement where we believe in the best practice under the measurement and believe that we should be aligned with that best practice, and where those measures are highly represented in multiple benchmarking or payment programs, so that we are both focusing on best care, providing best care, and understanding of how our reputation is generated through those measurements. And so we get ourselves down to about 10 or 20 a year. It used to be largely represented by inpatient hospital metrics, now hospital metrics, ambulatory care metrics, and some metrics across the continuum. And we put our central resources around those best practices that sit under the metrics, whether that's in the area of preventable death, or infection prevention, or efficiency, like length of stay and readmissions and the world of patient progression. But I think the magic is finding best practices that providers believe in and tying that to measures that are a part of benchmarking or payment programs, because you never want to come at it from the payment opportunity side. You want to come at it from the best care for your patients aspect. Yeah.
With the fact that you're tracking 400 things, do you feel like you have your arms wrapped around everything that needs to have their arms wrapped around? Or how does a new metric make it into that 400? What's the process there? Or is it like we already have four other measures that are already measuring this in some other way? So talk to me a little bit about how does a new metric make its way to be 401?
Well, actually, there are 10,000 metrics in our data portal. So apparently, it's not hard to become a new metric. But I think, the breadth of this business is in the external metrics, largely payment for performance. They cannot be ignored. They must be understood. And they have very specific definitions and data sources and time periods for comparisons and peer groups and risk adjustment methodology. And so I think the sort of foundation of my role is to be sure I understand all of those and I provide reporting on those. There's another layer that clinicians are far more comfortable with, and that is our registry data, where we supply, usually purposefully and deliberately, clinical data for clinical comparisons. And that is a different data set, has some overlap with the external benchmarking agency sets, but not entirely. And then, of course, there are lots and lots of custom and local metrics, because I can't manage all of these. And in my academic institution, my service line leaders, my department chairman, and our quality officers are all taking the lead for their populations and their providers to be sure that they understand best practice and they have measurement techniques to track it. So I guess the answer is that one cannot possibly track 10,000 things, but one must know what's out there and be sure that from year to year, you provide the tools people need to understand their performance and to measure an intervention to be sure that the return they were looking for is really there.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about an initiative that you guys did at UVA called Be Safe, which was based on lean principles. So talk a little bit about kind of what it took to stand up that program and what that was like at the beginning.
Sure. So lean methodologies have been used in healthcare more and more during my career in this space. They came to UVA when we had a new leader arrive as our very first executive vice president of the health system, supporting the dean, supporting the CEO of the medical center, and the president of the practice group. So for the first time, we had a single leader in this healthcare space at our academic institution. And with him, he brought lots of experience and lots of energy around the tools and principles that Lean brings to the table. I would say that the tools are pretty easy to implement, things like huddles, things like root cause problem solving, cultural aspects like a professional safety element that encourages and rewards escalation of problems, and then visual management of trends in your area. I think the tools were the easy part back in 2013, 14, 15. The harder part, of course, is to change how leaders think, to accept that in an organization like ours, everyone is well-trained and well-meaning. Not one person comes to work in healthcare and says, I'm going to hurt somebody today, or I'm going to cut some corners today, or I'm just not going to do my job today. That's just not how it works. So if you accept that everybody is well-trained and well-intentioned, then you have to really examine the systems in which they work to see why it is that these systems let them down so often. The books that have been written about medical error in the U.S. are unfortunately being rewritten with similar rates of medical error because we've focused on it for 20 years and can't seem to make a dent. And so the pieces and parts of that let good clinicians down are systems-based practices, systems that don't work right, that require us to cut corners or require us to do things in triplicate and then make mistakes, things like that. And so BeSafe really changed how we manage performance improvement here at UVA by bringing us a toolbox that we didn't have, but then changing our culture and our mindset around perfect patient care and the idea that you can and should get to zero harmful events if possible, and that you should be obsessed with perfection and alignment to best practices, proven best practices, and that you should study yourself. I think that's the most humbling part for our leaders, is that our visual management boards were meant to show them where their systems broke down and let their providers down and therefore potentially injured a patient, or at least left a patient without the best care that they deserve. And so it was a major shift for us, but it persisted through COVID and now lives on in, of course, a updated and refreshed way, but the core of it is the same.
Yeah, that's amazing. BeSafe has even been studied at the Darden Business School as an example of organizational change. So looking back on that whole journey, if you had a new chief quality officer reach out to you who's fresh in their role, kind of what recommendations would you give them to start along a journey like this?
Wow. And you can, as you can imagine, that happens, that phone call happens more than you might think. I think you have to be ready to change, again, the leadership mindset and the culture of your organization. And it's hard in medicine because we're trained to be expert, we're trained to be confident, we're trained to make hard decisions about other people's lives. And so this very fundamental idea that we are, as leaders, humble servants to a system that fails providers and therefore patients is really hard to wrap your head around. And so I always recommend a handful of readings. I recommend a couple of groups that are good at this. I always recommend a visit to a place that does this and does it well, and a bunch of conversations, peer-to-peer moments, to understand what it's like to be a CMO in a hospital that is obsessed with perfection versus being a CMO in a hospital that isn't running a system like this. And then I always tell people that you can do a lot by managing from the middle, and the chief quality officer is solidly in the middle of the organization. But without the strength and energy of your leadership, you're likely to fail. And so I think the magic is a leadership group that believes in this kind of work and a quality officer that can get some help and train up some coaches and use the tools. And after that, I tell them all to look for a home run and advertise the heck out of it. So in my own experience, I remember the day that there was a discussion at our leadership huddle around pressure injuries in spine surgery patients. And the new EVP turned to me and said, "Tracy, we're going to the OR and we're going to watch some spine surgery." And sure enough, we walked ourselves down there, put the bunny suits on, and stood in the corner and watched actually the prep for a spine surgery, which was where we realized why the pressure injury problem in that population was hard to solve. And it's a thing called the Jackson table, which is a metal table that folks lie on while their backs are being operated on. And all the pressure points of your bones are there to damage your skin. Yeah. And we just happened to have a conversation with a circulator, not an RN, but someone who was there to sort of help set the room up. He came up to us and said, "Who are you guys?" And we told him, and he said, "You're interested in pressure injury? Well, look at that table. It's a bit of a torture device." And we nodded, and he said, "I bet if I had a little bit of time to think about this and maybe somebody from infection control to help me design a material that was usable, I bet we could do something better." And so my boss said, "You know what, Clarence? You're on." And we got an engineer from our School of Engineering and a material scientist and somebody from infection control and got Clarence the day off. And they designed a new material and a new pad. And we tested it in our ORs, and the neurosurgery spine population pressure injury rate dropped by about 40%. And so it was a neat way to prove that if you go to the place where the work is being done, and you respect the people who do the work and their good ideas, and you provide some resources and then rigorously test to a very specific outcome, you can change the world. And we advertised that story, of course, to a bunch of our chairmen in the School of Medicine, to our administrative leaders in the medical center and the CEO's cabinet. And suddenly everybody wanted to bring us their problem and wanted us to put a little team together to solve it. And so those are the kinds of things that I tell people to look for. Find that home run, do it really well, prove that you improved care, and then advertise, and all of those problems will start coming to you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an amazing story there. Shifting gears a little bit. So, you know, a big part of all of this is managing physicians, managing physician performance and decisions. In your experience, you know, what actually moves the needle with physicians in terms of what motivates them versus what falls flat and everything in the middle?
Sure. I would say what motivates my colleagues and me is our patient outcomes. You know, we're here to take care of patients. We've given our lives to take care of others, and we want to give the best care possible. And so whether it's an objective clinical patient outcome that is different than expected, something like an infection rate that might be zero in one population and 40% in another, and 40% is too high compared to our peers, those evidence-based outcomes for our patients is what really motivates us. We want to deliver the best care. I would say there are some efficiency elements that motivate us too, because we want to do it as well as we can and for as many people as we can. So there are some process pieces as well that are motivating. But in general, what I try to do, and very simply stated, my first rule of thumb is that we should solve problems that matter. So if you bring me something that you want me to take on, I need to know how it is either failing or hurting patients. I need to know that it's a pain point for our providers. And I need to know that there's a best practice that we're not following. Those three things are what's required to change a physician. And I can tell you again, another simple story involves neurosurgery and a 40% infection rate in a specific population. And that infection happened to be C. diff, which is associated with your antibiotic prescribing behaviors. And I went to the chairman with three very simple graphs that I could have drawn with crayons. And one was that the rate of infection, C. difficile infection that these patients were facing, and this can be a fatal infection, was 40% higher than other neuro ICUs and in that population in our peer group. And that made us an outlier. Some of the surgery that we do is a little bit unique, but even if you take that off the table, it was too high. The rate was too high. That was graph number one. Graph number two was by provider, the very specific prescribing habits of the team in terms of antibiotics given to these patients. And the practices were all across the board and highly variable and not aligned to best practice. And material item number three was the front page of the best practice article that stated how antibiotics should be used in this population. And it was written by the chairman I was talking to. And so I basically said, look, Mark, we've got a patient problem and it's evident in this infection rate. We've got a provider problem and it's evidenced in this highly variable practice in terms of antibiotic exposure. And you wrote the best practice that they're not following. And the neurosurgery chair crossed his arms and looked at me, and I prepared for a loud conversation. And instead, he said, Tracy, I cannot believe you haven't brought this to me sooner. And we then took the 60 order sets that those physicians were using and aligned them all to best practice. And therefore, when the fellows and residents and others got into our EMR, they couldn't choose anything but best practice and watched their infection rate drop down into best in class. And so if you follow the data from a patient outcome that is unacceptable to a practice that is not aligned with best practice, then you'll have a very good opportunity to change behavior. And in fact, physicians will be grateful because they don't want to provide care that isn't perfect, and they absolutely don't want poor outcomes for their patients.
Yeah, that's another amazing story. So how do you feel docs respond to seeing data, comparing them with their peers, or even unblinded data? You think that's something that they're ready for, that they're eager for, that they're hesitant? Like, how do you think about when you share data back? Do you share it unblinded with the physicians where they can all see each other's data?
Absolutely. And I spent a decade earning that ability, because anytime you see data and it doesn't look good as a provider, physician, clinician, or any other expert, you dive into the multiple stages of grief, basically, and you argue and you bargain and you have lots of conversations that don't have anything to do with the actual best practice being measured. But if over the years you can be very clear with your physicians and say, here is a population of patients that are attributed to you because of this surgery or this data point in the record, or this is how they became your patient, so to speak, from a data management standpoint. And you can talk about how the data point was then collected so that you're very clear as to how you achieved this rate that you're sharing with them, whatever it might be. And you are willing to be wrong. Every now and then we attribute things to providers that shouldn't be attributed to them. So I always open up with a data set that they've never seen and say, here's some information I'd like to share with you. And here's the data management approach. And I want to learn from you whether or not we've come about this in the right way. And if you do that enough times that they trust you and they get used to seeing data like this, those conversations get shorter and shorter. And then you get more quickly to the heart of the issue, which is whether or not we have an actual trend in outcome that is worthy of a central improvement effort.
Yeah, we strongly support sharing data unblinded. If you really want to drive accountability and ownership, you don't want folks to be able to hide in the data. And so, yeah, we're strong believers in that as well. You'd mentioned some articles I had read about the Be Safe initiative. There was talk about a situation room and some IC data boards. And talk to me a little bit about that and how those were actually used to then change behavior or change initiatives?
Sure. The situation room is the physical space that we called the room where the leadership huddle happened every day. And maybe to just talk a little bit more about that cascading huddle approach. When we started, we began with a shift change huddle or an open clinic huddle. So in the inpatient units around 7 a.m., the nurses turn over night to day, and they do an extensive handoff, and lots of reporting of overnight events is discussed. And so we took advantage of that opportunity to create a first morning huddle in the inpatient space, and then, of course, a procedure and clinic opening huddle in the same way, where we basically asked the teams, outgoing, incoming, what went well yesterday, what didn't go well yesterday, what risks do we have today, and can we mitigate those risks? And if not, we provided them with a huddle they could take those concerns to. And so our tier one huddle is first thing in the morning, bedside providers and changeover of shift. The next huddle is our service line huddle, where groups in heart and vascular or groups in pediatrics or groups in oncology will come together and say, okay, these three clinics are worried about capacity today, or this this set of ORs is likely to run late and therefore have staffing problems or whatever it might be. You can think of all sorts of things. Supplies are endless opportunities for improvement, supply and equipment availability. But basically, we said to the front lines, when you do your 7 a.m. models, put some stuff on the board that you're worried about. Then we want you to huddle together at around 9 or so with your service lines. Let them know in case it happens to be a problem across the house. And then at 10 a.m., the EVP is going to be physically present to hear your worries. And sure enough, every day, the executive vice president met me at 10 a.m. and first about 50 people, then about 200 people. And now, of course, more than that because it's a virtual opportunity. And so the magic was that he was there physically listening as things were escalated. And at that point, of course, they're escalated from the service lines because there's only so much time in the day. And we kept that meeting to about 15 minutes, maybe 30 total. And that was where I think a lot of trust was born because people would come with problems that had affected their work every day for years, things like supply and equipment availability, or problems with the way the EMR functioned, or staffing issues, or communication problems of all kinds. And we listened and we deployed solutions teams. Some of them were easy. Some of them are just do-its. And others involved bringing the right people together who were disparate in the organization and therefore not comfortable talking. And so that was a little bit of it, networking and sort of relational coordination approaches. But I think the real magic was in taking on hard problems, putting central support groups to try to solve them, using root cause thinking and real-time root cause problem solving, going to the place where the work was done and trusting the people who do the work to tell you what was wrong and listening to their good ideas, respecting their good ideas to design improvements, and then resourcing improvements, actually spending some money, hiring some people, doing the things that actually change the way you deliver care, and then bringing that back to the institution to say, okay, we got this problem in the situation room. We deployed a improvement team. And now we're coming back with a new bed fleet, as an example, in a co-development opportunity with one of our vendor partners. And we've seen an improvement in falls and pressure injuries and bedside nurse time in terms of calls for help and pressure testing, whether or not that felt good to the institution. Of course, it usually did. So I think, again, the tools are important. The will is important, but listening and resourcing solutions to problems that folks escalate is absolutely key and will buy you the goodwill when you misstep and your solution doesn't quite hit the mark or you misunderstand the problem or somehow you as a leader fail your team. It, once you've proved a few times that you can solve a problem, then they'll be willing to say, well, actually, Dr. Hook, this is headed in the wrong direction. Thank you for everything you're doing, but let's regroup. And once you have that sort of relationship with the people who take care of your patients, the people who take care of your building, the people who provide food and housekeeping services, then suddenly all 10,000 people in your organization are working towards best care. And that's an engine that will not be stopped.
Yep. It's amazing. One of the topics that's always close to all chief quality officers is all the ratings, star ratings, Leapfrog, CMS, and those do carry a lot of weight in terms of reputation and reimbursement and patient choice. So how do you look at those programs? Do you look at them as a direction to steer the ship, or do you look at them as lagging indicators of the real work that happened upstream?
So I try to be really careful about bringing somebody else's interpretation of our practice to the table as truth. And I spend a tremendous amount of time, and my analytics team, my data scientists, spend a tremendous amount of time deeply understanding external algorithms, data definitions, data sources, peer comparisons, risk adjustment models, so that when I bring a set of metrics to the table, and as example, U.S. News and World Report is embargoed as we speak, about to go public next week, I will not bring U.S. News' impression of the University of Virginia. I will bring my impression of their measurement system and say, here's where they got their data. Here's the time period, happens to be 3 to 5 or 3 to 7 years old. here are the definitions, and they're not the same as our internal benchmarking or our registries or our academic peer group partners. Here are the outcomes and why we are ranked or not ranked in one way or another. So I spend a tremendous amount of time dissecting those external benchmarks so that I can interpret and make recommendations for the organization about which ones we do want to align to, either because they are good measures and the data is trustworthy, or because those measures align with things that we have already put at the top of our own list. But you can't use external benchmarks as truth. They conflict with each other because their data sources are different, their time periods are different, their definitions are different, their risk adjustments are different, peer comparisons are different. And so I try to keep our eye on our internal tracking and trending of outcomes that we have said are important to us, whether they're important to our patients, our providers, our leaders. And then I try to connect the dots to how that looks in someone else's benchmark. Because if you've been in this business for more than a minute, you know that you might be bright green in a metric called central line associated bloodstream infection in one benchmark and bright red in another for the exact same time period, the exact same patients, ostensibly the same data. And so I try to be really careful. And you have to do that as a quality officer in all venues, at the level of the board, in public communications, in internal communications, not fighting or denying or further frustrating folks, but just really helping people understand what exactly is this metric showing? What does that red dot mean? What does that green arrow show? And then deciding whether or not that's the arrow you want to follow.
Yeah. When you think about that library, whether you look at the 400 or the 10,000, what's one metric that maybe you think hospitals over it emphasize or focus on, and maybe one that they are not paying enough attention to?
One of the metrics that shows up in lots of benchmarking services is a set of sepsis management metrics. It's important to have sepsis management metrics because sepsis is a very common killer of hospitalized patients. It is very common upon presentation to the hospital in certain patient populations. So it's important. It's important to patients. It's important to providers. This is where those ICU wards come in that you mentioned and I forgot to talk about. However, the current metrics as designed by CMS and others are reflective of best practices that are probably a little outdated. And so the idea that we should collect labs, lactate values, as an example, on a schedule that fit a best practice that has now been updated in the clinical world just so that we can get that gold star feels really disingenuous. And so that's one, as an example, of the 10,000 of the 400 that I've said to our groups, we will let this one go. Our ICU docs don't believe in it. Our review of the best practice doesn't support it. We don't think there's any malfeasance here. We think it's just outdated. We think it's just not a good process measure for a very important patient outcome. And so we're not going to focus on that one. But then there are things like preventable mortality reduction, which we will always have a team focused on. There are things like infection prevention that we will always have teams focused on, whether it's central line associated infections or catheter associated infections or post-op wounds, surgical site infections, any of those always will be at the top of the list. I think one place where hospitals can go astray in this work is in the coding documentation integrity space, because as doctors, we're taught to write what we think so that another doctor can understand what we think. We're not taught to write so that a biller can follow 10,000 pages of coding law that change every year to then turn our thoughts into codes that then become bills that then become data. Yeah. So I do think you can get down a rabbit hole pretty fast if you focus on the coding documentation integrity piece without balancing that with the actual care delivery piece. There's definitely some work that needs to be done there because, again, if you're a hospital as big as ours, you have so many people writing essentially what occurs to them, not necessarily writing to a template, even though the notes are built that way. And so there is some value for sure of helping people understand that these are the words that convey the kind of illness you're talking about to someone who then might need to turn that into a bill, which then might come back to us as outcomes data. And so I think that's one place where lots of energy is spent and maybe more for metric management than for actual outcomes improvement.
Yeah. I got, I think, two more questions to wrap it up. So where do you see the greatest opportunity in quality and patient safety over the next couple of years? Where are things moving to?
Personally, as an old school physician, I think there's a lot of back to basics practices that we need to shore up. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to do something innovative, something new, something that involves technology. Absolutely, if you can get the word AI in there, people are excited about it. But in general, I think it's some of the very basic practices, things like hand washing and infection prevention, things that we know work, that there are best practices for that we follow, but perhaps not perfectly. Communication, the idea that your best communication venue is face to face. We depend so much on what's in the chart or even a academic decision tree that then has the two least experienced people talking instead of the two most experienced people talking. And then, of course, this team-based approach that has such value in terms of bringing perspective to the table that you just might not have noticed. And so to me, this the very foundational aspects of caring for people, following the very basic best practices around the day-to-day care of a human being, following the most logical communication streams that should at least at some point involve the patient, potentially their family, and the experts at the table, and then people like me providing systems that function to promote best practices, to make the right thing to do the easiest thing to do, so that least experienced person opens up that kit to put in a central line and sees everything that they need in the exact order that they need it. I think those are the things. You know, what everybody is thinking about, of course, is what can AI do for us? What can't AI do for us? I think it can absolutely see patterns in big data that the human cannot see, certainly not at the rate that it can ingest and manage data. But I think there's also an art to this business and a personal connection to this business that it will never be able to manage. And so we've got to figure out how to capitalize on it. You know, how can we use those kinds of technologies to advance the practice of medicine in a way that it puts better data in front of providers to make the decisions that providers still need to make and to have the conversations that they still need to have.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, last question I could think of for now. Big picture item, how would you frame up for hospital administrators quality and patient safety? And what do they not fully understand about that topic of quality and patient safety?
Well, having been a hospital administrator for 15 years, it's hard for me to get outside this box. But I will say, having been at times the only clinician at the C-suite table, at the board table, et cetera, I think what's hard for business people to understand is that patients are highly variable in terms of what they bring to the table, whether or not they do the things we ask them to do in terms of risk mitigation or medication adherence or exercise or any of the things we ask, and that providers are highly variable in their ability to communicate, in their ability to manage their time, in their ability to manage a team or be a part of a team. And so if you are thinking that you can come into this business and treat it like we do our supply chain improvements, as an example, you're destined to fail because the inputs are so highly unpredictable and the behavior of the people within your processes is so highly unpredictable. And so you really need to be sure that you're putting as many good processes in place such that the variability from best practice of the people is minimized, but still allows for the art of this profession. And it is a very fine line to manage that, because as a business person, if infections are bad, then you think they should be zero. And understanding the fact that certain populations, my neonatal cardiac kids, as an example, with central lines in their groins and poop in their diapers, there are certain populations in which that's going to be very, very hard. And that's very different from a patient with a different diagnosis on the adult ward who's going to be in and out in a week or two, and trying to really help the board understand, trying to help the C-suite understand the inherent variability in the work that we do, even as we try to strive for perfect, where perfect is known. I would say the other thing that has kept me in the C-suite all these years is that when I do put something forward under the umbrella of quality and safety, it's always because it's better for the patient. It might be because we are not practicing to best practices, whether that's a Joint Commission standard or a trend in academic ICUs. And I put a return on investment on the table. This is where my understanding of all of these benchmarking agencies and metrics matters, because sometimes I can't put a financial return on the table. Sometimes I have to say, this is going to cost money. In order to do this well, or in order to do this as is expected, we are going to have more people or a different equipment or something that's going to cost money. However, if we do this and achieve this metric or these metrics, we will bump our leapfrog grade and or our turn from our Anthem QHIP payment program, our big blue insurer, and that's of value to you. And so I think that's the piece that you can always come around to in the C-suite is, if I can't give you a financial return or a proven efficiency, I can provide you a reputational bump. And then, of course, always reminding that the reason why we do this is for the patients, not for any of these other outcomes.
Yeah. Well, Tracy, thank you so much for joining us today. This conversation was amazing, and I love the stories that you share, which kind of bring this all to life. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.